cool guest. I think this is going to be somewhat enjoyable, and some people may not like it, but we're going to have a good time anyway. So, Peter, welcome to the show.
Hello, Nancy. How are you? Nice to be with you.
I'm okay, Peter. Now, before I start, Peter, would you please explain to the people a little bit about who Peter is and what prompted you to write your book, Pope Annalisa, and we'll go from there.
Sure. Well, I was in a recently former life an international hotel developer, and I traveled around the 3 or 4 continents on a regular basis. Prior to that, when I guess the background, probably the segue leading up to the development of the book, was that I was always, I guess, kind of a spiritual seeker from a fairly young age, and I had some very formative, I guess what you call spiritual or psychic experiences, however you want to term them, where I did contact higher intelligence that was allowing me to do various things, some of which were intuitive medical readings for people. But I guess the one thing that you could say I really got out of those experiences was the fact that I had tapped into a higher intelligence, and that higher intelligence was really the energy that binds us all together as human beings, that we're all from one source. Because with the kind of information that I used to get about people, places, events, and things like that, there was really no way I could know this unless I was tapping into or mining into a common energy source that would allow me to see these kinds of things. And so it left me with a tremendous sense, the fact that there is a unity, an underlying unity in the world and among people. And that pretty much set the course for the rest of my life. And it was certainly one of the main things that led me to want to share some of those experiences in the form of the book Pope Annalisa and the first Souls trilogy, of which the book is part.
So is the book based upon fact or is it based upon fiction?
Well, it's a fictional novel, but it's pretty much based upon fact. Most of the phenomena that occur in the book are things that I've actually been through or that I have experienced with or through other people. And the spiritual traditions that are spoken of in the book are based on actual traditions that were once part of our Western world but were suppressed or destroyed by the early development of Orthodox Christianity. This spiritual tradition I'm speaking of was one that really ran like a thread through almost every major religion that we have in the world today, and even through the what they call the so-called pagan religions of the past, the Eleusinian mysteries, the Egyptian mystery schools, the Oracle of Delphi, the worship of Isis. These were all various forms that embodied this spiritual wisdom, and you can see remnants of it today in the Western Abrahamic religions in the form of the Kabbalah in Judaism and Sufism in Islam. Now, the mystic equivalent in Christianity was Gnosticism, but unfortunately, the Christian church did a great job in eradicating its own mystical core, much to our detriment, so we don't hear as much about the Gnostics today. Except for the fact that in 1945, they made a tremendous find in the deserts of Egypt when they unearthed some Gnostic Gospels that have shed an entirely different light on Christianity, on Jesus and the disciples, and on what was being taught in those days.
The info that was, unearthed, so to speak, have we even come close to hearing about it or the truth about it?
When you get finds of this magnitude, and I'd put the Dead Sea Scrolls into this same basket, they very often get delayed in terms of being brought to the public. Now, some of that's for legitimate reasons, which is that they have to be restored, they have to be translated, interpreted, and so forth. There are other reasons, political reasons, unfortunately, and religion gets involved, where some of this information is really, I'm not going to say incriminating. I think that would be too dramatic, but let's say it's maybe contrary to some of the status quo, so there are some retardant forces out there which delay the publication of these documents. But it took, for instance, the Dead Sea Scrolls, I think, almost 50 years from the time it was discovered to really, or 40 years or so, to really become available to the public. They're pretty much out there now. Some portions have still been, I believe, of these Gospels are maybe still under wraps, but substantially they're out there now. Yet it takes a while. These are very arcane texts, and I think, for instance, we owe a debt of gratitude to certain scholars like Elaine Pagels from Princeton University, who has taken some of these very complex Gnostic myths that were written originally in Greek, some in Coptic, and made them understandable or intelligible to the modern world, because they're in a context and they use words and terminology that would normally be hard for the reader to understand. But if somebody is really seeking for them, there are now, finally, works out there that can help one wade through this and understand the symbology behind it. Now, it's sort of like peeling back the layers of an onion, Nancy. There you can go more superficially, or you can really get deep down to the core. You would probably have to read quite a few books to really get an overall understanding of what is really being said and the meaning behind the symbolism in these myths. But I would say that, yes, nowadays we have quite a bit of it available for people who really want to find out more about the subject.
Do you think it's real important, especially now, considering the phase that the Earth and spirituality and human mankind is all going through, is pretty important for people to start taking a different look at what we have been taught so far, so that we can understand maybe a truer meaning, not just what might be somewhat of a made-up meaning?
I think that we are definitely going through a shift, in many things, but particularly in consciousness right now. And I believe that these things are somewhat cyclical, but maybe I should say, rather than cyclical, I should really say they're more like a spiral. We do tend to come around in a circle, but I do believe that circle is leading us slowly upward like a spiral. And in the, I think probably many of your listeners are familiar with the whole concept of the left and right brain. And for those who aren't, our brains, which are basically electrical currents, are sort of polarized, as is much of the physical universe. The principle is like a yin yang principle, and they have found out that there are attributes of the brain that they call left and right brain functions. Now, left brain functions include analytic thought, logic, language, science, and math tend to be more practical and analytic in their application. The right brain is embodies design and creativity. And right brain functions would be more holistic thought, intuition, creativity, art, and music. The ancients called this male and female energy. The Gnostics would have called it male and female energy. So you find Jesus, for instance, in the Gnostic Gospels, constantly saying the two must become one. Now, what did he mean by that? What he meant was that we have to take these energies within ourselves, within each human being, and bring them into balance, or bring them into an operating symmetry. And once we do that, if we could really balance our all these faculties of, you know, intuition and logic, creativity and linear thinking within us, we would become very dynamic, whole, and complete human beings, and we would be able, therefore, to further as a species our own evolutionary development of consciousness and in a transformative way. So I do think that an understanding of these things that we've been talking about is very important, because there was a time when the religions of on Earth, the spirituality on Earth, tended to come more from the female qualities. These were the days, for instance, when you had the worship of the goddess, the Magna Mater, Isis worship. What it was all about was a form of intuitive worship that was very close to nature. We swung to the opposite end of the spectrum in the last couple thousand years, so that we had very patriarchal forms of society, culture, and religion, which tended to be more external in the way they went about things, hierarchical, external, dogmatic. A good example of this would be the Catholic Church, and not the only example, but one that most Westerners would be familiar with. And I think that we're now experiencing a time where this rising feminine energy and these faculties that I'm speaking about are coming back into balance, and more people are awakening to the fact that a purely material view of the world is a dead end, and it's not satisfying, and it's led to a lot of grief and unhappiness and a lot of conflict. And more people are seeking spirit, and in order to seek spiritual solutions or spiritual alternatives, they're getting in touch with these what we call these feminine faculties of intuition and creativity and holistic thinking. So I think having a framework of understanding of that is important in this coming age to help guide us.
The children that are coming into the world today appear to have a lot of different qualities than what we as adults look at, and we have a hard time with that concept. So, like the children that have been labeled with ADD, ADHD, you know, the children that appear to be in a different reality, although they're trying to, you know, transform to this reality in order to stay. Do you think, excuse me, that the children that are here today and that are continuing to come in are coming in at a much higher vibrational level than we are, or do you think they're just a little bit more developed and have to try to fit in to a lower vibration that we have created?
I think that it's probably a little bit more the latter. I do think that they're probably coming in with a greater potential, and certainly it's not just the innate potential they come into, but it's a different world than what we had out there. The way the world is being transformed, even on the left brain side, the technologically speaking, how the world is transforming, so that they have a very different view of things. And you know, we were more exposed to the written word and the type of thinking that the written word would bring with it, whereas the young people coming in are more visual and multidimensional, and they're learning to think visually and in other ways that we probably had to struggle with. So I think it's a combination of maybe the children are coming in differently, but also they're certainly being born into different circumstances than those that we face. But I certainly, when I take a look around at young people now, I just feel that they're probably light years ahead of where I was when I was their age for a variety of these reasons. Of course, the thing that happens is that as the society is used to functioning in a certain way, yes, they do tend to vibrate the children down to that level. So that, you know, the way that, for instance, in my generation, if children were found to have extraordinary faculties of perception that allowed them to see things, they were very quickly trained out of that because the parents were afraid of that. That wasn't normal. That wasn't something that should be happening. And they'd take them into a doctor, or they'd take them into a psychiatrist or psychologist, and they would do their best to, quote, normalize them, unquote. And I think that still goes on. I think it's going on less so because I think the parents, these younger generation of parents, have probably learned something too. And I think as part of the shift we're talking about, they're probably more open to it. So I suspect that they're not as restrictive as maybe their parents were. I think it gets a little bit more broad-minded and open in each generation, but I still think there's probably a certain amount of socialization that happens to these gifted young children, to these children that have broadened perception.
Do you think that using the drugs that they're using on these children is of benefit or help to them?
I'm not going to claim to be an expert in this area by any stretch of the imagination. My sense is there should be other ways to deal with these situations other than drugs. And I see these drugs doing more harm than good. And I believe that there are other ways with deeper understandings that the parents and the people who assist the parents in terms of aiding the children in their development could be going about things. I probably had what would have been called attention deficit disorder as a young person, and I tended to, my mind tended to track on a lot of different things at once rather than focus on one course. When I used to take examinations, you know, the standardized tests like SAT, I always used to see a multitude of possible answers in the questions, whereas they had designed these to track on one in one way. I wasn't seeing that one way. I was seeing that one way plus two or three or four other ways. And is that good or bad? I guess it is. I guess that's kind of relative. I suppose, you know, of course we have to be focused to conduct certain activities. But if we design our children to exclusively think in that way, I think we're cutting out a lot of higher potential and possibilities.
I think so, too. For your book, please give out your website and where they can get your book.
The website is popeanalisa.com. Contains a wealth of information about the thematic background of the book, including Gnosticism, Mary Magdalene, the early female leaders of the church, what happened to them, the confluence of ancient mysticism and modern science and quantum physics, how they are saying the same things, except with nowadays, of course, different technological terms, and it has some videos on the book itself. And the book, actually the official publication date is coming up in about 2 days. The book should be available right now, though, through order from any major bookstore because it is on the major databases, Ingram & Baker and Taylor, so that if you don't find it in the shelves, but you go into a bookstore and ask for it by name, they should be able to look it up in a computer and order it for you.
Okay. Because I read the book. It's actually a very good book, and parts of it I'm sure some people may not have a good time with. And other parts of it, it may help them to understand a little bit better. Now, it's a series of books that you're writing. So this is the first, and you're going to do at least a couple more. Is that true?
That's correct. It's going to be a trilogy called the First Souls Trilogy, which has to do with the fall of spirit into materiality, the first souls to come into material existence. And they are sort of archetypical for all of humanity, and the trilogy traces their lives through different epochs of human history.
Now, when you were writing the book, I know you said earlier that a lot of it came through some of your own, you know, your own phases that, let's just say, you went through. But as a child, did you know a lot of things, say, for example, psychically? Did you know a lot of things would be happening or a lot of things appeared not to be the way you had been taught? How did, you know, all the information from you growing up basically transform into this first book and, I would think, into the rest of your books?
I would not say I was very conscious of experiencing psychic phenomena as a child. More what I experienced in my early years was a sense of alienation, that something wasn't quite right with the world or something wasn't quite right with me and the way I fit into the world. And I suppose that that's not all that uncommon, especially as we go into our teenage years. We often have these feelings of alienation, but I guess the difference with me is that I made a career out of it. I probably obsessed over it a little too much, and so I became sort of a seeker. I really found out more about the tapping into the higher energy and the psychic abilities actually in my early adult years, in my early 20s, when I first discovered I could do intuitive medical readings, psychometry, psychokinesis, and things of this sort. The book is a confluence of different parts of my life. Part of it certainly was what I experienced from these things that we just discussed. Part of it came from my travels and the people I met in my travels. I would have these figures kind of appear in my life unsolicited, like a yogi, you know, coming down and talking to me when I was walking the streets of Bangkok just out of nowhere, and like he knew me, and starting up a conversation, and a variety of what you would call shamans or bush doctors when I was living in Africa. And each of these people that I met would seem to validate something about the path that I was on, as if to say to me, this stuff isn't fantasy. it's real and it's happening to you, and you know, we're sort of here to be signposts for you. So that was really incredible, the way it was almost like the universe was sending me these people to keep me on the path. I also had a love for writing. I never really had any indication earlier in my life to be a fictional writer or a literary writer, but I did always have good writing skills and writing abilities, which I used in business. I did a lot of the marketing for our companies, and I had to write with clarity and persuasion. I always enjoyed communicating and, you know, with people, especially, you know, to expose a certain point of view. And I was a voracious reader, so I had about 25 years of research behind me in spiritual and religious matters. And one day I was in a screenwriting class in New England, and the instructor came in and said, I would like you to write about something that nobody has ever done before, which is kind of a tall task because almost everything we do is a permutation of something else in life. But being spiritually oriented, I guess the way my mind thought was, well, what haven't we seen before? We certainly haven't seen a female become hope before. And I kind of took off from there in terms of, well, what would the world be like if we had a female pope? What would the circumstances around her papacy and what would she face if she had to break into an institution that was exclusively male for 2,000 years? How could that possibly happen? So I started off on that whole line, and then I brought everything to bear. It seemed like all the past experiences that I had had in my life really crystallized around this whole idea, and I was able to bring all these experiences, which I never would have dreamed when I was living in Nigeria, that those experiences would so strongly contribute to me writing a book later on. But it all sort of came into place, and all those different streams converged into one torrent, and it kind of flowed out as a combination of my own channeling from my meditation and information that I was getting, and also from the studies and the research that I had done over several decades.
In your book, you talk about the first souls. So let's talk a little bit about your book so people understand a little bit better. It's up for a lot of awards, and I've already won some awards. So in your book, you talk about first souls. So who are the first souls?
Right. Well, the first souls were the first spirit, the first spirit intelligence to manifest in the material world. Now, the ancient spiritual tradition that I've referred to a couple times, and I probably should give a little bit of information here as a background to explaining the book. The ancient spiritual tradition was not a religion. It was more an orientation or a wisdom teaching that was the mystical underpinning for almost every religion. And it's rather hard to boil it down or distill it into one overarching definition, but I would say certainly a major characteristic of this spiritual wisdom was that there is one source of energy or intelligence, and you can call it the Supreme Being, God, divine intelligence. I leave it up to the listeners, whatever they feel comfortable with. I think you'll get the idea. But this one source manifested itself as many different sources, so that the I am essentially became the we are, and the end product of that emanation or projection of spirit outward is the human being. The human being would have been considered by the ancients to be a crystallized form of this divine energy vibrating at the lowest level. And that is a very different orientation when you come to think about it from what Judeo-Christian tradition has taught us, because in the Judeo-Christian story, human being was more or less a lump of clay, and God breathed life into it, and then it went ahead and it committed original sin in the Garden of Eden, and essentially we've been trying to repay that debt to, you know, this judgmental God for almost an eternity now. But it almost pictures us as like these little wind-up dolls that God created, and now we're bouncing off the walls of an earthly insane asylum trying to get out from under the yoke of original sin, which is, when you think about it, it's a pretty lowly state for humanity to be in, to subscribe to that point of view. The ancient wisdom tradition, I think, was a much more dignified and exalted picture of what humanity really is by saying that we are projections of the divine essence, and we are incarnated into this material world for the purpose of spirit experiencing individuality, separation, and projecting spirituality into the material world. So in some senses, you can say that a human being or human beings are like the fingers of God touching the face of material creation in order to bring spirit into materiality and to bring the experience of materiality back to spirit. And that is, I think, a very beautiful and an exalted explanation of our origin, our purpose, and our destiny, and that would have been a major part of the ancient spiritual tradition. Now, getting down to Pope Annalisa, it's really two books in some ways. It's a thriller. It's about an African nun who rises through the ranks of the church by means that I won't get into detail here, so it kind of gives away much of the thrill and excitement of the book. But she does become the Pope of the Catholic Church, and upon doing so, and this is a world, incidentally, in the near future, the year 2025, it's a rather bleak world in the sense that there's a scarcity of resources of oil and water, which are causing the nations to become more competitive with one another. Iran has gone nuclear, and when Annalisa becomes Pope, everything really goes to hell in a handbasket. There's an impending war between the United States and Iran, which threatens to go nuclear. Islamic terrorism has really run rampant. The Catholic Church has been divided by Annalisa's papacy. In fact, the whole Western world is divided on the eve of a nuclear war, and people are wondering, well, is this woman and the new way that she's bringing in, this new vision of Christianity, this new vision of spirituality, is she going to be the savior or the destroyer of this world? Is she the cause of all these problems, or is she going to be the solution to these problems? So throughout much of the book, we really don't know what the character of Annalisa is about. We're really not sure about what her agenda is. And I think that complexity is reflective of the fact that around all great figures, and let's take a concrete example, Jesus of Nazareth. When Jesus was about his ministry 2,000 years ago in Palestine, there was a large portion of the population that thought he was a sorcerer. He was doing these magical tricks, and he was turning people's eyes from the God of the high priest. And many people despised him and feared him and thought that he was really up to no good. Then, of course, you had a whole other segment of the population that viewed him as a healer and as a savior and a figure who was trying to bring light to the world. And I think around every great figure, there's always this controversy. It's not so simple. And people must make their own judgments about what these people are about, and that's much the situation that the reader finds themselves in Pope Annalisa. So besides the sort of plot of the Islamic terrorism, the conspiracies, the assassinations, all the things that go on and make this book a fast-paced thriller, there is this underlying spirituality in the book that speaks to this ancient spiritual tradition, the recovery of this ancient spiritual tradition, which very much had to do with the early female leaders of the church. During the course of the trilogy, it talks about what happened to them, what happened to the feminine legacy, how figures like Mary Magdalene got pushed aside, and it talks about bringing back this tradition that was once very much a part of mainstream Christianity. Now, I might mention at this juncture for clarification, for historical purposes, because everything I'm talking about has a historical basis. This is not fantasy by any stretch of the imagination. But early Christianity had two broad streams to it, Orthodox and Gnostic. The Gnostics, as we've mentioned, were the mystics of the Christian way who penetrated through their meditations and various techniques. They penetrated through to this higher intelligence and brought back guiding information to impart to people, which they did in their Gospels, mostly in the form of myths, because much of this, when you bring back information from the higher levels, it's often very difficult to communicate to people on a mass basis. So in those days, they would develop a sort of mythic story with symbolism in it to explain what the guiding intelligence was telling them, and it was quite astonishing. But the Orthodox Church really developed in a different direction. The Orthodox Church was much more hierarchical. They started, you know, of course, with the priests and the bishop and the hierarchy of leadership, and they developed certain dogmas that essentially cut this whole mystical aspect out of the Christian religion to the point where they couldn't abide by their own mystics anymore and what they were saying, and they felt they had to destroy them because what the mystics were saying was really, in many ways, contrary to the literalism of the Orthodox Church and the hierarchy of the Church. So, unfortunately, you had what you would call the outer Church or the Orthodox Church destroying the inner Church or the mystical Church, much to our detriment in the Western world.
Do you think that, let's use the Bible as an example, using it as an example, and I'm sure this is going to upset some of the listeners, but I still have to ask it. There are parts of the Bible that appear to be very much fantasy land, and yet people follow it, you know, like this is the last word. Is there a point that the Bible will be, let's not say discarded, but taken apart in different directions so that the people can really understand what the Bible has to say and what part of it has been, you know, made up through the several different authors and people who have interpreted? Or do you think that with the upbringing that we've had for so many years, that the Bible itself is going to be the one and only way of people are going to continue to look at different faces of religion?
I think we have to respect our scriptures, even though they may have been redacted or edited from you know, over the ages. And, you know, what I would say is, Nancy, there's a saying in the book, which is that prophets speak the heart of God, their followers start religions. And I think it's almost always going to be that way until we get to the day where everybody has a direct experience of the divine and they no longer have to rely on faith, because faith is a proposition that our religions ask us to rely on, and it's sort of secondhand information and interpretations that we're asked to believe. And that is in distinction to direct knowledge, which is what the Gnostics were always after and what the Gnostics achieved, which is a direct knowledge of the divine intelligence. Now, when you have an experience of something, you don't have to take it on faith anymore. When you have a direct experience, you know it to be true. You've gone through it. It becomes essentially part of your being and part of your way of life. I believe everybody, because we have the divine spark within us, has the potential to have these mystic experiences if they have the desire to do so. But to answer your question about the Bible and the scriptures, no, I don't think the Bible is going to disappear, nor I hope it doesn't disappear. I have a great respect for the Bible. I think that what happens with any story, there's probably never going to come a time where we can historically prove or disprove the Bible one way or another. When you have things that are lost in the mist of history, unless you find a real smoking gun of a document out there that's buried in some desert sands of the Middle East, and maybe something will be discovered one day, I don't know. But I don't think that we will ever know the complete facts about, you know, is there a historical Jesus? Is there a historical Mary Magdalene? Did the resurrection really occur the way they said it was? I think that people are probably well served by looking at the Bible as you can look at the Gnostic Gospels and the myths in the Gnostic Gospels as an archetypical story that is pointing towards an understanding of the spiritual dimension. And if we don't get caught into taking everything literally, and we keep our minds open that the stories in the Bible may be trying to tell us something symbolically, and it could be a combination. It could be a combination of literal history. It could be a combination of symbolic archetypes. But I think if we keep an open mind, that the scriptures, whether they're non-canonical, whether they're Gnostic scriptures or the canonical Bible, that there's a story in there that can serve us well. And I think where we get really hung up in the whole question of religion, and the book Pope Annalisa is very much about spirit transcending religions, different religions and their religious differences. And the difference that I would say between spirit and religion is that if we look at both as a long road or a continuum, and there's way stations or bus stops along the road, we, to a certain point, or we get to a stop along the way, and religion would say, here's my bus stop, stay here, punch your ticket, and you know, kind of believe what I'm telling you. And that stunts our growth, because if we stop there, we don't continue along the path. Whereas if you took a more spiritual outlook, you would say, okay, I've learned what I could at this juncture, and now I'm going to take this and build on it and continue on my spiritual journey. So what I'm saying is, if we take the book Pope Annalisa, or if we take the Bible, and we say those are signposts to help us along our spiritual growth, but don't mistake the signpost for the destination. Keep moving, you know, up that spiritual ladder of understanding. And I think when we take that kind of an attitude, I think we're better served.
Do you think your book is in conflict with the Bible?
No. No, I don't. For the reasons that I just cited, I think that the book presents other possibilities for people to think of to interpret the biblical story, and I think that there are other documents out there, such as the Gnostic, that point to a different teaching that was in existence at the time, in biblical times, than what we've been handed down. But even in the Bible itself, you have hints of that. For instance, it says in several passages in the Bible that unto the masses Jesus spoke in parables, but to the disciples in private he spoke the true mysteries. The early church fathers have said this, that there's a letter by Clement of Alexandria, one of the early church fathers, who says that St. Mark had brought from Rome after St. Peter's execution, St. Luke had brought from Rome a different document which purported to be the secret teachings of Jesus, and that those teachings were only given to the elect or the spiritually mature who were ready to receive them. The Gnostic Gospels say the same thing, but in much greater detail. Essentially, what they're saying is that there was an oral teaching that Jesus handed down, which was part of a chain of teachings that permeated all cultures and the mysticism of all cultures throughout the ages, and that Jesus was a highest example or proponent of this mystical wisdom, and that this was taught to those that were spiritually mature enough to be able to understand them and apply these things. So it seems pretty clear. There's great circumstantial evidence out there, both from the Bible and from non-canonical texts, that there was a mystical wisdom teaching that was going on secretly or going on quietly. And I think that's probably because the population way back then wasn't really ready to receive this kind of spiritual knowledge in a mass transmission. But I think today one of the changes or the shifts what we're talking about is I think people are ready to receive this knowledge. I think that you have a much more educated population. They're more spiritually clued in general. There's a little bit more of an understanding of the fact we are in a spiritual dimension as well as a material dimension, and I think more people are primed to receive this message today.
Okay, we have a couple callers on. They both, I'm assuming, will want readings. So before we take the caller, can you give out your website and the